From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're going to start this hour in a city where the coronavirus numbers don't look good, but cutting-edge testing has just become available. Detroit and its surrounding counties have more than 8,000 cases, and it is the first city to get rapid test kits that produce results in 15 minutes or less. Joining us now is Sarah Swick, reporter for Michigan Radio. And Sarah, tell us more about these rapid tests and why Detroit is getting them first.
So these tests come from Abbott Laboratories, and as you noted, they are supposed to give results in as little as 15 minutes. Detroit is getting an initial batch of about 5,000 and also five machines to process these tests. And as for why Detroit is getting them first, so far as I know, the story is that Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan managed to get a hold of the cell phone number of the CEO of Abbott Laboratories, gave him a call, and presumably expressed to him that the need was really great in Detroit. And so within a few hours, they managed to get a contract, and the shipment arrived and started being used yesterday.
Now, the city is using these tests for healthcare workers, plus bus drivers and first responders. We know the virus is already taking a toll on those groups. One striking example, a bus driver who last month posted a video to Facebook about a woman coughing without covering her mouth. That bus driver has now died, and police have been hit hard. What's happening with the police in Detroit?
Well, in terms of the Detroit Police Department, right now there are over 500 officers in quarantine. More than 100 officers have tested positive, including the Detroit Police Chief, James Craig, and they're being quarantined. So the hope is with these rapid response tests that they can rapidly test the folks who are in quarantine, including as well firefighters and bus drivers. And if they test negative, get them back on the job as quickly as possible.
That is Sarah Swick with Michigan Radio. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
To Louisiana now, where the state's health department is reporting the highest single-day surge of confirmed coronavirus cases so far. More than 9,100 people are infected. At least 300 people have died, more than 100 of them in New Orleans. The city's hospitals are warning they may run out of beds and ventilators in the next few days. Dr. Jennifer Evegno is director of the New Orleans Health Department. Welcome, Dr. Evegno.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
Yesterday's spike reflects the fact that results are coming in from a backlog of tests, some of which were more than a week old. Why is there such a delay in getting the results of the tests, and how's that affecting your work?
Well, that's a good question, Lisa. Our state lab was the first to start testing, obviously, and as of now, the bulk of the tests being run in Louisiana and New Orleans, like most places around the country, are from commercial labs. And we were the first federal pilot drive-through testing site selected, and the test from that program is being run through commercial labs as well. You know, we're processing thousands and thousands of tests a day, but unfortunately, the commercial labs have really not been able to keep up with their promised turnaround time of anywhere between 3 and 5 days.
What is their turnaround time instead?
It really depends. In recent days, they've gotten somewhat better, but we still have tests that are outstanding from 12 to 14 days. That's something that is incredibly frustrating to us. We've got citizens calling us anxiously awaiting their test results, and we don't have them to give them. We've really put the pressure on the commercial labs to ramp up the information that they're giving to us. But from a health department side, from a city side, from a modeling side, it really makes predicting and planning very challenging.
So the governor says the New Orleans area is set to run out of hospital beds and ventilators this weekend. This sounds like a terrifying scenario. How do you expect to be able to get, and do you expect to be able to get more ventilators?
Well, we've been putting in requests for weeks now to the federal government. Our governor stated, I think it was a couple of days ago, he had put in a request for close to 13,000 ventilators and gotten 192. Now, I believe that another 150 were shipped yesterday, and they're being deployed to the regions of most need. But we continue to ask for ventilators from the stockpile, manufacturers, everywhere that we can in order to be able to meet the needs of our hospitals.
We know that people with pre-existing conditions are more vulnerable to to COVID-19, your department has reported 40% of all people who have died in New Orleans from the disease had diabetes, 25% were obese, 21% had cardiac problems. Are you delivering a message to other states that might have populations with similar pre-existing conditions?
Absolutely. Our messaging has been very clear. If you have a chronic medical condition, we need you to stay home. We need you to protect yourself because the consequences for you becoming ill are generally far more severe than a young, healthy person. And I just want to say to other areas, don't be afraid to test. You can't fight what you can't see. And so we hope that by getting a hold of this early as we have, we can really fight it as best as we can.
Of course, the tests only work when you get the results in time.
Absolutely.
Dr. Jennifer Evegno is director of New Orleans Health Department. Thank you so much for speaking with us. Good luck.
Thank you, Lisa.
Well, now let's turn to Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, looking at what's going on through the lens of social media. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
And we are, a lot of us are working from home right now because of social distancing. And there's a viral tweet that has reframed the thinking around that. Tell us what it is and what's the story behind it.
Oh, it's such a good one. It's from Neil Webb. And he says, "You're not working from home. You are at home during a crisis trying to work." This was something that he'd heard repeatedly. And he says, "I think it's an important distinction worth emphasizing." And it so resonated. 100,000 retweets, 300,000 likes, and people were sharing their struggles. Artist Al, for instance, says, "I'm still trying to teach art, but most of my kids don't have supplies at home. I feel like an utter failure." Sam says, "Thank you for posting this. I really needed to read that. That was like a comforting pat on the back." And one more, because it resonated so hard. This is from Monk Chips. Monk Chips says, "I call it coping from home." If you want to see that tweet for yourself, go to @NeilMWeb. Neil will probably tweet back at you because he's nice that way.
Okay, good. Now, many of us have been using Zoom, this video platform that hosts business meetings and just fun hangouts with family, et cetera. People are even teaching school classes through Zoom. We should note that Zoom is a funder for NPR. But there have been some concerns over something called Zoom bombing, and people are warning others on social media about this. What is that, and what are they saying?
Well, you think of it as a video app that people are able to troll or gatecrash. They're being obnoxious, maybe offensive. They're jumping into a video gathering they haven't been invited to. All of that sort of stuff that we're used to on social media. And I just looked up Zoom bombing as a hashtag, and I found a couple of really good examples just from the last couple of hours. So PeopleScape, HR and Search tweets, "My 11-year-old school history class of 35 kids was Zoom bombed yesterday by young adults showing private parts and using foul language. It was quite an eye-opener for the children." I don't think it was meant to be funny, but I did laugh at that. So their history lesson turned into a biology lesson accidentally. But there are lots of tips that you can use. And so I went straight away to the source at @Zoom_US. And they said, "We appreciate the scrutiny. We know we've had a lot of criticism." And they posted a blog, and their blog was really interesting. It says, "We did not design the product with the foresight that in a matter of weeks, every person in the world would be suddenly be working, studying and socializing from home. We need to do better." And they've got training videos. They've got little webinars so that you can actually learn how to use Zoom well. So basically what they're saying is read the instructions before you jump online. So you have meeting settings, you have privacy settings, you can host, you can curate. It's a bit like leaving your door open and say, "Hey, everybody come in." That is probably not a good idea. Close your front door, put a bounce on your front door, you'll be fine on Zoom.
I have 4 Zooms set up this afternoon.
You're
I haven't
showing
seen
off.
Anybody Zoom bomb yet. No, some of them are
fun. Is that
fun,
an invitation?
Some of them are working. Yes, I would love to have you in any of those Zooms. Femi, one more thing we have to talk about because it really has
because you
out
wanted
there
us to
media.
Talk about it, Jeremy.
Well, exactly. I wanted us to talk about it. It is celebrity chef Ina Garten, also known as Barefoot Contessa. She took to Instagram on Wednesday to show us how to make what she called
so
her
good.
Favorite cosmopolitan. Listen to this.
"During a crisis, you know, cocktail hour can be almost any hour. Okay, now, the last detail is really important, a good martini glass. I'm going to show you the one I like."
Okay. And she's going to show you the one she likes. She pulls out a giant martini glass about the size of her head. She fills it up and takes a big sip and tells people to stay safe. This was shared at 9 o'clock in the morning.
It's so beautiful. And it is a genuine recipe. So she says 2 cups of vodka and then pours in the entire bottle of vodka.
Right.
She has been called the quarantine queen. I know for president, she's an entire mood. I also highly recommend that you go to her Twitter feed. There is delicious food, there are recipes, and also she shares on social with warmth and kindness. And her tweets are really comforting at this really difficult time for many of us who are stuck in our homes, working from home, maybe not be able to do all the social things that we can normally do. And that recipe is really easy. I already have my limes ready.
Oh, good. Well, you know, and the thing is, we're all doing so much cooking and maybe even so much cocktail drinking right now.
Exactly.
We could use some new recipes. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, you've made us smile on this Friday. Thank you very much for that.
Cheers. Stay safe, everybody.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Today's monthly jobs report from the Labor Department marked the end of 10 years of job growth in this country. More than 700,000 jobs were lost, and that's probably just the beginning. We're joined now by Mohammed El Arian, Chief Economic Advisor at Allianz and President-elect of Queen's College, Cambridge. Mohammed El Arian, always nice to speak with you.
Wonderful to be back. Thank you.
Well, and how long do you think that this economic downturn is going to last, and how bad will it get?
We don't know. We all want to have an answer to that critical question, and we simply don't know. It's not an economic issue. It's not a financial issue. It's a medical issue.
It's a medical issue right now, but could it become an economic issue down the road, even if the coronavirus gets under control? A lot of people have been laid off. Maybe not all of them will be hired back, and people will have a problem going out into restaurants or to sporting events or any conferences that people get together. Isn't that going to have a lasting effect?
It will, and there's three elements to what you just said, and I think each of them is challenging, and the three together show why this is truly a generation-defining moment. The first one is simply navigating what is a massive hit to everything we do, and that will result, unfortunately, in a lot of bankruptcies and, unfortunately, in the sorts of unemployment rates that we have never seen before. The second element is that the restart is not just flicking on a switch. There's a notion that once we get the all clear from the medical side, we're simply going to flick a switch and the economy is going to operate again. It's not. It is very complicated to get an economy that has been subjected to a sudden stop back on track. And then the third element is that the landscape post-crisis is going to look very different. We're going to have the following. One is a major hit to productivity and therefore growth potential. Second, we're going to have much higher debt and a much greater entanglement of the public sector in private sector activities. That is almost inevitable. Third, we're going to have question marks about institutional robustness and effectiveness. Fourth, we're going to deglobalize the economy at a faster rate. And that leads to the fifth theme, which is we're going to go from a focus on efficiency, just-in-time delivery, to resilience. Let's build resilience into the system.
Give me an example of what you mean by that, building resilience into the system instead of efficiency.
So we're coming from a world in which companies really had really bought into global supply chains because you can minimize cost, just-in-time inventory management, because that lowers how much cash you have to put out to carry your inventory. And now they've realized that if there's a shock to that system, it's a question of survival. And the shock really started to sink in with the trade war. And now, with what first happened in China and what's happening today, people realize that we should have a home bias. We should bring things home. And we should build in resilience in every element that we can manage. And that's not just going to be about companies. It's going to be about us.
Are you worried about a shock to our financial system? If businesses cannot pay back their loans, could banks all of a sudden see a wave of defaults and then we have a banking problem as well?
Monday, a few weeks ago, we came very close to market failure. But the Fed, with the support of the Treasury, moved in and addressed in a very laser-focused way these market failures. So I don't worry about the whole system freezing up. But you raise an important point. This shock, unlike 2008, did not start in finance. It started in the real economy. But it's starting to undermine finance. And if you're in a bank, let me make it very simple. If you're in a bank, you have a real dilemma ahead of you. On the one hand, you should lend because a lot of your clients are facing short-term problems. And if you withhold new financing, you risk turning short-term problems that are temporary and reversible into long-term solvency issues. Liquidity problems become solvency. So that collective interest and the interest of your client tells you lend. But if you're safeguarding your balance sheet and your business, and you don't know how long this is going to last, is it going to last 3 months? Is it going to last six months? That calls for you to be cautious. And every bank right now is facing that dilemma. We are trying through Federal Reserve measures to align both collective and individual incentives, but it's proving to be very hard. So let me take an example of a small business. They have no earnings to speak of. If you're a restaurant right now, you want to keep on your people, but you can't pay them. So this dilemma, and we face it as individuals. Why did we collectively empty out the shelves for certain products? Not because it's in our collective interest, but we were selfish. So it is very hard when people are taken out of their comfort zone in such an abrupt and violent manner to align both individual and collective incentives. It's a shame because we are collectively in this and we collectively get out of it together, not through individual actions, but it's hard.
We have got so much going on in the world's biggest economies. This virus came out of China, the second largest economy. Now the epicenter is the United States, the biggest economy. Europe is a mess right now. What about countries that we're not spending that much time talking about? How worried are you about the emerging markets of the world? Turkey, Argentina, South Africa, Brazil, places like that.
I'm not just worried, I'm terrified. First, the healthcare system there is weak. It will be overwhelmed very quickly, which means, unfortunately, people dying, and people dying in much larger numbers than we've seen so far. Second, to protect the rest of the population, governments will try to do exactly what we are doing. The notion of governments are all in, whatever it takes. The problem is we can afford it. Many of these countries cannot afford it. So while they will understandably follow our footsteps in going all in for relief, pretty soon the reality of their situation is going to catch up with them.
What do you think the United States should do from an economic standpoint? We've already got three packages, including the $2 trillion relief package just passed. Now there's talk of another multi-trillion dollar package involving infrastructure, but there are already some signs, especially from Republicans, of hesitancy about putting the U.S. even more into trillions more in debt. What do you think that the U.S. ought to do?
So first, it's not surprising that we're seeing hesitancy. typically you get what's called adjustment fatigue. People are tired. You know, what, you want me to do all this all over again? The reality is that it's not enough to design programs. You have to implement them. And we need to find faster ways to get money to people who are in real pain. And people are in real pain right now. We also have to have principles. So one thing that I think I'm worried about is we have started bailing out certain sectors, the airlines, Boeing, without answering very basic questions. Why are we doing this? When are we doing it? How are we doing it? And how are we going to exit? On what terms? And the reason why it's important is because the airlines and Boeing aren't the exception. They are just the leading indicator of a massive supply and demand destruction, consumption and production, that's hitting industry after industry. So we need to develop general principles instead of just going ad hocly one company or one sector after the other.
Income inequality was a major problem well before COVID-19. It's gotten worse over the last many decades. But do you think that in a post-COVID world, it's going to be even worse than it was before? You already see sort of the velvet rope economy developing, where some people can get the care that they need. They can be in a situation in isolation that's more pleasant than others. And then there are so many people who don't either have health insurance, maybe they're afraid to go to the hospital if they have symptoms, et cetera. What is it going to look like on the other side?
So if we don't do anything about it, we are going to see the inequality, not just of income, but of opportunity, get a lot worse. And that concerns me, and it should concern every American, because that's the basis of the social contract. And as I tell people over and over again, and this applies to corporations when it comes to social responsibility, you cannot be a good house in a bad neighborhood. You just can't. How good your house is also a function of a neighborhood. And the neighborhood we all live in, no matter whether we're in a good house or a bad house, has been hit hard. And we will need an element of collective responsibility to address the neighborhood. Otherwise, everybody's going to converge towards the bottom as opposed to people converging towards the top.
That is Mohammed El-Arian, who is the chief economic advisor to Allianz and president-elect of Queen's College, Cambridge. Fascinating to hear your thoughts on this. Mohammed El-Arian, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you for having me. I really love conversations with you.
When you consider coronavirus cases on a per capita basis, the number of cases per 1 million people, the country at the top of that list is not China or Italy, it's Switzerland, which has around 1,300 cases per 1 million people. The population of Switzerland is around 9 million. And the Swiss health minister said today the outbreak has not yet reached its peak there. Joining us now from Bern, the capital of Switzerland, is the BBC's Imogen Folk. She is on Skype. Imogen, is there an explanation for the high number of cases in Switzerland? Is it just because it's right next to Italy?
Well, that would be part of it. And the fact that, you know, we have big, really strong and historic connections with Italy here. People go back and forth for holidays. They have family there in northern Italy. They work on either side of the border. One thing, if you talk about cases, one thing you should look at is that Switzerland is actually testing a lot, and more, we are told, than a number of its European neighbours, and certainly more than, for example, the United Kingdom. I know that at least on one day this week, Switzerland did 16,000 tests in the space of the 24 hours. Hmm. So they are doing that. But at the same time, a more reliable figure is deaths per million of population. And there Switzerland stands at number six, behind Spain, Italy, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, I think. So still, for a very wealthy country with a very sophisticated health system, that's a worrying figure.
Well, and you say a very wealthy country with a very sophisticated health system. How is the Swiss healthcare system coping with the demand right now?
Well, what we heard just today, in fact, from our health minister, Alain Berset, was that not all the intensive care beds are yet full. So that is a good sign. But as he pointed out, the number of cases is rising fast and the beds are filling up fast. So it's kind of typical Switzerland. He used a mountaineering metaphor and said, we haven't reached the peak of this crisis. We haven't got to the summit. We can't see the other side. So no chance of any of us being able to go anywhere or do anything in the foreseeable future. We've been told not to even think about traveling, not even across Switzerland. At Easter, the schools will not open. There's no date on when they might reopen. So, and they've pointed to the fact that in Wuhan, the lockdown lasted 2 months before there was any relaxation at all, and suggested that's what we might be looking at.
Imogen, how is the lockdown affecting daily life for people in Switzerland? Are people following the restrictions?
They are, but it's not easy. This is a country of apartment dwellers. You know, a large part of the country is mountain and not livable. And people live in relatively small apartments. Families live in small apartments. So now the kids are at home. The parents are at home trying to work from home and make sure their kids carry on with the kind of distance learning that's been introduced. And it's really, really not easy. And one of the things the Swiss government announced today, well, confirmed, is something that they're worried about and looking very closely at, is the rise in domestic violence. People get frazzled in these situations.
That is the BBC's Imogen Folks speaking with us from Switzerland. Imogen, thank you.
My pleasure.
Restaurants across the country are closed to customers who want to dine in, but they're eager for customers to order takeout or delivery to support the business. And people are obliging. According to data from the review site Yelp, food delivery has doubled since the coronavirus outbreak. These days, you can't help but wonder, though, if it's safe to have food delivered to your home. Don Schaffner is professor of food science at Rutgers University. Welcome, Professor Schaffner.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. The CDC says there is no evidence associating food with the coronavirus, but is it safe to order takeout?
Well, and in fact, it might even be safer to order takeout than to go to the restaurant and pick it up or to have takeout delivered, right? So using services that deliver or getting takeout yourself are all great ways to practice social distancing and still have food to eat.
Okay, but let's circle back on that. Is it dangerous to get takeout food and pick it up yourself?
Well, I mean, again, to the extent that we can limit contact with other people, that's what's going to reduce our risk of contracting COVID-19. Again, we don't know that there's any risk from food. So all of those things can proceed as they did before the times of pandemic.
So when you get food delivered at your doorstep, you're still having contact with the person who's delivering it.
Well, you know, it depends on what the delivery service is doing. Many of these services are instructing their drivers to actually practice social distancing as well. If you've ordered with one of these app platforms, you may have paid online, so there's no cash or being exchanged. There's no credit card being physically exchanged. And again, many of these drivers are being instructed to simply leave the food on your porch and then alert you that it's there. And then you can minimize even that interaction with the driver.
And what happens if you do have to pay, say, cash or a credit card when the person arrives with the food?
Well, then you should do that, obviously, and give them a really nice tip because they're out there putting themselves on the line to deliver your food.
Yeah, because we're not the only ones who are possibly being endangered, but the delivery people.
Exactly. They're as worried about getting COVID-19 from you as probably you are from them. So if you have to pay with a credit card or pay with cash, then obviously you should do that. And then since you have interacted with another person, it's a good idea to sort of raise a flag in your mind. Hey, next chance I get, perhaps when I go in the house, I'll wash my hands or use hand sanitizer.
And if you've used a credit card, should you wash that or somehow disinfect it?
Well, you know, what I'm recommending to people is do whatever makes you feel safe. If it makes you feel better and less anxious to do that, I'm recommending that people do that.
But that's confusing. I mean, either the virus is swapped by, know, anything, piece of paper or a credit card. Why wouldn't you have to sanitize your credit card?
Well, here's the thing. We can take this to an extreme degree where we're basically sanitizing everything that comes in to our house. The key message here is that most of the cases are spread by symptomatic people coughing or sneezing near people who then breathe in the virus. There may be, again, there's evidence of asymptomatic spread. There's still, at this point, not any evidence of spread through contacting surfaces like money or credit cards.
So with that in mind, once you get the delivery in your kitchen, you're unpacking it, what's the key thing to remember there?
Once you bring the food into the house, you can discard that outer packaging, right? And so either recycle that or throw that in the trash. And then, again, just on the off chance that you maybe perhaps have gotten the novel coronavirus on your hands, that's a very good time to wash your hands or to use hand sanitizer.
You mean before you start digging in?
Yes, absolutely. So after you've handled the packaging and before you start eating, and guess what? Washing your hands before you sat down to eat, that was a good idea before the pandemic, and it's going to be a good idea after as well.
Although, I don't know if we all sang happy birthday two times before, but I guess we really should right now. And what about if you're sharing takeout with a friend or a roommate? Can you share a spoon? Can you share the Chinese takeout in any way?
Well, so here's the thing. If this is a person that you are living with, you're already sharing germs with them just by simply being in the same physical space. And so if this is a friend who you don't live with, well, you should be social distancing from them. So they shouldn't even be there, right? But if it's somebody that you already live with in your house, I don't see any problem with sharing the takeout. Now, that equation changes. If you have someone in your house who is sick, that individual really should be quarantined in the house. They should be eating separately from everybody else. But if everybody is healthy and no one is symptomatic, I see no problem with sharing a meal together.
Let's say when you get groceries and bring them back from the store, do you have to sanitize those?
Well, again, my recommendation is that you don't need to sanitize your groceries. Again, a best practice is after you come into your house, it would be a really good time to wash your hands or use hand sanitizer. After you've put your groceries away, wash your hands or use hand sanitizer one more time. And then thirdly, again, before you sit down to eat, wash your hands or use hand sanitizer.
Do you wear gloves when you go out shopping?
I don't wear gloves when I go out shopping. What I do at my grocery store, they have hand sanitizer at the entrance. And so I will apply hand sanitizer when I walk into the store. When I leave the grocery store, I will again apply that same hand sanitizer from that same station. And that's to basically remove any coronavirus or inactivate any coronavirus that I might have picked up in the store.
Given how much you know about food science, it is your specialty and you teach it. How do you balance the science with just the natural kind of anxiety that we have around a pandemic?
I know about microorganisms. I know how they're transmitted. And I know specifically how this one is transmitted. Remember, this is something that spread from person to person. The best thing I can do to protect myself is to not be around people who are coughing or sneezing. And then the secondary possibility of infection via cross-contact with surfaces, I'm managing that by washing my hands and by using hand sanitizer and by trying to, you know, not be too nervous about everything.
That's good advice, and I hope we can all accept it and adopt it. Thank you, Professor Don Schaffner, food science professor at Rutgers University. Nice to speak with you.
Yeah, same here.
Schools have been forced to close because of the coronavirus, so students all over the country grabbed their backpacks and headed home. But there are some students who can't go home. Alicia Abbott's son is one of them. Abbott lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Every Sunday, my husband and I drive 40 minutes to pick up our son, Finn, in the house where he lives. Finn is 12 years old. He's lived at this home with 8 other boys for the past 3 years. All of them attend the New England Center for Children. It's a school that serves children with autism. Finn lives there because his needs are beyond what we can provide. It would be physically dangerous for us and for him to keep him at home. But we have our Sunday visits, and this is sacred time. Every Sunday is blocked on the calendar, reserved for Finn. When we bring Finn back home for the day, we take him to all his favorite spots, to CVS to buy Tic Tacs and the supermarket to buy fried chicken wings. We go to the local park to watch the dogs run and play. But our routine was disrupted this month because of the coronavirus. We're no longer allowed to take Finn home on Sundays or any day. Last week, the school wrote us a letter that said, if you want your child home, then you are taking them for the duration of the crisis. We can't even go to his house and wave at him through the window. This would only upset him. He wouldn't understand why we couldn't come in. So, instead of visiting, I sing to Finn on Skype. I blow him raspberries and make our dog Smokey bark. Anything to make him laugh, a sound I crave. My son is nonverbal. He relies on a system of pointing and pictures to communicate. I ask Finn, how much do I love you? And he shoots his hands up in the air. I raise mine too and say the words that he can't. So much. I understand the need for the school's restrictions. They're to protect Finn, his housemates, and especially the dedicated staff that watches them around the clock. But I also miss the feeling of his touch, his hand in my hand, my fingers through his hair. We're grateful for the care and love provided by Finn's attendants. The state classifies them as essential workers, and they are absolutely essential to us for supporting Finn and for keeping my family together. I feel for the other families at the center, especially those whose autistic children just attend the day program. These kids have to be home full-time now without the routines they depend on to stay regulated. The kids and their families have to make do. So the anxiety of this time is being felt by everyone, even those without the means to understand what's going on.
Alicia Abbott is a writer who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The Affordable Care Act was signed into law in March of 2010. A decade later, it has survived many attempts to repeal or weaken it. So what role is it playing now that millions of people have lost their jobs amid the coronavirus crisis? Let's bring in Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So there's been a big question about whether the Trump administration would reopen enrollment for the federal health insurance exchange offered under Obamacare. Would a special enrollment period be helpful now, not just for people who've lost their jobs and insurance, but maybe for people who chose not to get health insurance and now feel like they need it?
Yes, it's more the latter than the former. If you lose your job and your health insurance, that's considered a life change under the Affordable Care Act, and you automatically have a special enrollment period where you can sign up for coverage. What a full open enrollment period would do is let those people who didn't sign up because they didn't think they were going to need insurance, and now they're theoretically not eligible to sign up until next year. It would let them sign up. It would also allow people who bought some of these what are called short-term limited duration plans that don't necessarily cover everything, it would allow them to sign up for more robust coverage. A lot of those plans are not going to be of a whole lot of help if you end up in the hospital with COVID-19.
What about the expansion of Medicaid, which is something that a number of states did, some states did not? What does that mean for people who are suddenly unemployed and will need health insurance?
Well, this is the first time since the Medicaid expansion began in 2014 that we've actually seen it out there as an option for so many people. Right now, there's all but 14 states have expanded Medicaid, which means if you completely lose your income, which many people just have, you are eligible for Medicaid. It doesn't have most states' premiums. It has very small, if any, copays. That's what Medicaid is for. It's supposed to be what's called a countercyclical program, that when the economy goes down, Medicaid rolls go up. But now that so many more people are eligible, we'll have to see how that goes.
And what about COBRA, Julie? A lot of people are wondering whether that's going to be helpful for them if they've lost their job for the moment.
Well, COBRA is a 1986 law that lets people keep their employer-provided health insurance when they lose their job, but they have to pay the entire cost. And people are often shocked to discover how expensive their employer health insurance is, since most people don't pay the full amount. They pay just a portion of it. So it's, if you lose your job and you don't have any money, COBRA is going to be really expensive. But if you have a pre-existing condition that requires ongoing treatment and you're worried about keeping all of your same providers, COBRA can be a good option if you can afford it.
And will all insurance plans be required to cover coronavirus-related medical costs?
Well, that's still up in the air. Several large insurers have said that they will. We are starting at Kaiser Health News to see bills from people who, you know, were supposed to get quote unquote free tests and who may have gotten the test free but are getting all kinds of ancillary bills. So this is mostly happening through kind of, you know, public pressure by the Trump administration. There's no requirement so far. And the other thing that people are worried about is that if so many people get so severely ill, that's going to be a problem for the health insurers going forward, and they might have to raise their rates for everyone. The hope and the idea is that people who get this disease will not be bankrupted by medical bills.
The coronavirus relief bill passed by Congress last week designates $100 billion to hospitals. How would they use that money?
Well, ideally, they would use that money to beef up staffing and bed capacity. Ironically, even though they're full and overflowing, hospitals are losing lots of money because they're not doing the elective types of procedures that make them a lot of money, just sort of standard stuff that people go to the hospital for. The people who are there with COVID-19 are mostly extremely sick and using an enormous amount of hospital resources. And there's already people talking about maybe they're going to need more money.
Julie, it has been 10 years, as we said, since the Affordable Care Act was passed. We're now in a economic emergency, a public health emergency, and the Trump administration is still trying to kill the ACA. There's a case that will come before the Supreme Court in the fall. What do you think this situation is going to do to that lawsuit and to do to public attitudes about the ACA?
Well, reporters continue to ask the president and some of these governors and attorneys general in red states who brought this suit whether they still want to go ahead with it, and they all say yes. I do think, and I have said this publicly, that when this is all over, Americans are going to have a very different view of their healthcare system. I won't predict what the country might do because of that. But I think, you know, most people don't use healthcare very much in any one year, and they don't have sort of overriding anxiety about needing to use the healthcare system. And that's obviously changed just in the last few weeks. Everybody's worried about healthcare. Everybody's worried about being able to get healthcare if they need it. And I think we may go back and have a real sort of revisit about what it is that we want from our healthcare system and how we might want it to change.
That is Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thank you as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.